I just want to talk about a little more about some of these different options for soil amendments. The first one I have listed is peat moss and coconut coir. Do you have coconut coir?
I haven't noticed it. I'm sure.
Do you know what it is?
We
call it coconut coir. C-O-I-R. And it's the husks that have been pulverized. So they're, you know, it's a fine material, but I'm thinking you're more likely to have that than you are to have peat moss. Do you have peat moss?
I get peat moss, I think.
You do?
It's more available, I guess.
Is it really? Okay. Because, I mean, peat moss is going to come from Northern Europe or Canada or...
I know about some places that have it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think, I mean, it comes from very cold places.
Oh,
like,
it's
yeah. I mean, we have it in a few places in the United States, but most of the peat moss by far that we get comes from Canada. And then Northern Europe, you know, the far northern countries. It's just a good filler of organic matter. And so we use it as a, for example, when we, if we want to make up our own potting mix, the peat moss is, that's kind of the base that we work with. But if you're, and it, peat moss and coconut coir in America are sold in bales. They're usually plastic wrapped bales that, you know, about this wide, this high. Is that something that you have in garden supply stores?
I'm not saying coconut stuff. I'm not an expert.
But, you're seeing peat moss.
I swear I've seen a place where they harvest it from.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. It's probably not the same quality is my suspicion.
It could be. I don't know. So, anyways, in the United States, there's quite a debate among, you know, ecology-minded organic farmers as to which one is better, the coconut coir or peat moss. You know, there are some who say that the peat moss is non-renewable. I mean, it is renewable, but they're concerned that it's not renewing as fast as it's being taken out. There are others who say that's not the case. It is being renewed. Anyways, for us, peat moss is, and the other thing is transport. You know, so for us, peat moss is closer and more local. It doesn't take as much transport as coconut coir. Coir, yeah, that's C-O-I-R, and it's the outside husk that's been pulverized.
You're talking about something that's quite like a powder, aren't you?
Yeah, it's not quite a powder, but it's
not
fairly fine.
It's
not
a mulch.
It's
not a mulch.
It's something that's yes.
Rather
layer,
I think.
Yeah. So the organic soil amendments, we're just talking about peat moss and coconut coir. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar enough with Australia to know what's commonly available in garden stores and that sort of thing. And that's, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, those are good if... particularly if you're wanting to pot things or start transplants and that sort of thing. But it is handy to have something like peat moss or coconut coir. We'll use it when we're making a new garden bed. just to add a bulk of organic matter into the ground and give it a, you know, kind of charge the ground with organic matter. And it's probably the cheapest and easiest way to do that quickly. And it usually, for us, it usually comes in plastic wrapped bales that are about 30 to 50 pounds. And they're about this size and this tall, and they're compressed in plastic wrapped bags. So we'll add probably about two bales probably about one bale for 50 feet of garden bed. That's a 30-inch garden bed. So that's just a, like I said, it's a way to add a lot of organic matter quickly into your ground, and it's a kind of an easier and cheaper way than most anything else. Now, compost can be used too, and what we'll usually do is we'll put that much peat moss on our bed, and then we'll come and maybe add that much compost on top of it. So we're adding both, but we're just really trying to bulk up on the organic matter in the soil initially, just to get it going. And once we've done that, we don't ever add peat moss to our soil again after that, but we keep adding some compost every year. Or having a mulch on the surface. So the next option for organic matter is going to be things like manure, cow manure, horse manure, chicken manure, things like that. We are starting to get a fad in America for veganic farming. That is farming without any animal products. I don't know if anyone been talking about that here. Yeah, we're talking about animal waste. I mean, it could be any animal product, the animal parts as well as waste, but primarily waste. Well, I feel that there is some good reason for doing that, but I don't buy it just across the board. The reason behind it is that most animal manures that you'll find bagged and for sale in the shops comes from what we call a CAFO. That's a centralized animal feeding operation.
So we call them feedlots.
Feedlots, okay. Yeah. So I think we used to call them feedlots, but they're always generating new kind of fancier terms. So, so that's your big stockyards where you have thousands of cows just on a lot, or chicken operations, you know, huge chicken operations, or, you know, anything like that. That's a centralized animal feeding operation. And those kinds of places tend, because of the close confined conditions of the animals, they have to treat them with antibiotics, and they often treat them with hormones for, you know, growth and things like that. And almost for sure they're feeding them GMO feeds. And, you know, for all of these reasons, and as well as the fact that we just think it's wrong to do that, we don't want to use animal products from those kind of situations. And so, like I said, most anything that you find bagged is you can almost be sure it's coming from one of those situations. But I don't have a problem with, you know, if I've got horses or my neighbor has horses or, you know, cleaning out the stall and using that. You know how those animals are being cared for, and you know that to me it's two different situations.
The only thing to be careful with the horse one, I got a whole load of free horse manure and discovered that in fact they worm their horses.
Yeah.
So if you use that, it kills all your worms, which I think is what happened.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I had a whole lot of research to verify.
I mean that makes sense, but I haven't. Mm. I hadn't come across that before.
Well, when you verify that, that's what I was told.
So
I was
happy to. Yeah.
The what?
Where I live, some people sell and buy the road manure.
Oh, do they?
And you can pick it up, but you don't know. Like alpaca, for instance, they think where it is as well. Just like horse manure.
Yeah.
And I live on a cattle farm.
Uh-huh.
So.
So have you had that experience also or heard that?
I'm not a gardener yet.
Okay.
But I've heard that and I've been
You have heard that, okay.
I've heard people who actually sell their manure and they say that.
Yeah. Interesting. I hadn't come across that before, so that's something to think about.
Yeah, we sell horses and whenever I worm them, I put them out. I move them to another area for 3 or 4 days, so
okay.
The manure will go in the paddock.
So yeah.
Paddock, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good. So that's kind of our thoughts on using animal manures. If you are going to use a manure, you know it needs to be aged. You don't want to use it fresh. It would be good if it was dried, or you know, if it's moist, you'd want to make sure it had been turned several times, and I think I'd want to wait at least half a year. On any of these things, any kind of thing that's composting and breaking down, the more it looks like soil, the better it is. You know, if the more that you can recognize what the original product was, it hasn't aged very much and it hasn't broken down very much, so it's going to do more breaking down in your soil. And one thing about the more breaking down it does in your soil, it's tying up your microbes because you know they're needing to work to break it down. If it's already broken down, it's not going to tie up your microbes as much, and you'll have more microbes free for your plant. In the earlier session, I was sharing with them that it's the microbes in your soil, the bacteria and the fungi that do the actual transfer of nutrients from the soil to the roots. And so you want to do whatever you can to foster a good microbial population in your soil. And so, you know, the classic example of this is wood chips. If you dig wood chips into your soil, they will be a good source of organic matter, but it's going to take some time for them to break down, and they will tie up your soil big time, and you won't be able to produce anything good on them for I don't know, you know, maybe up to a year, and you know, so you just don't want to dig heavy things like that, large things into your soil that aren't broken down already. I think I'm just going to finish going through this because I wasn't going to use that for this list of organic soil amendments, and then sources of, you know, the when you buy fertilizer, if you buy a fertilizer, just a regular non-organic fertilizer, it has three numbers on it. You know what those numbers are? Yeah, NPK. So that's nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. Sorry, the other way around. Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The K is potassium. So fertilizers are rated on those numbers, just those three things. And so the even in America, again, even organic fertilizers are often rated with those three numbers. And so you can have an idea of what you're getting. Now, generally, with an organic fertilizer, those numbers aren't going to be very high. But those numbers are not really an indicator of the value of what you're putting on when you're dealing with organic things. Like, for example, compost is going to probably have a 1 for nitrogen. But it is still really beneficial for your soil. And you know, it's providing, again, like I said earlier, it's providing food and housing for your microbes. So so at home, the organic sources of nitrogen that we have used are things like alfalfa meal. That's just ground up alfalfa. And cottonseed meal. You know, any kind of seed meal is going to be high in nitrogen, because all seeds are high in nitrogen, in protein. We've used peanut meal. And, you know, if you've got a place that's making peanut oil, the cake that comes out afterwards could be a good thing to use. It would be high in nitrogen.
Flaxseed?
Yeah.
Put that on? Is that good?
Yeah. That might be a little more expensive than some other things, though.
Yeah, I get the 10 more bride bags.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, if you any seed, if you have a good source and you can get it, you know, for a reasonable cost, that's great. Yeah, you do want it ground up. You don't want it sprouting and growing. we have a farmer not far from us who grows organic soybeans, and we get cracked soybeans from him. So they're actually just broken in two or three pieces. They're fairly large. And we found that works really nicely if you've got a crop that's overwintering in the ground. Like we plant strawberries in the fall, and they go through the winter, and we harvest them in the spring. And the soy we usually put something else for nitrogen, you know, right when they're first transplanted, to give them an immediate nitrogen source, but this cracked soybean gives a long-term nitrogen source that lasts through to spring. And so that's... Yeah, we sprinkle it on top and just, you know, put it in just a little bit in the top. So, you know, that's a real nice thing for nitrogen. Blood meal is something...
Sorry, did you have the lights on?
No, we watched the video, that's why.
Yeah. blood meal is a very good source of nitrogen that we have used quite a bit. And we've stopped using it in the last few years. Not because it's not good, but again, because we're recognizing that it probably comes from a cattle, you know, a feedlot.
Is it blood and bone, or just blood?
It's just blood. And for us, probably close to 90% of that is pig blood. Yeah. But, you know, if you don't have anything else, it does work really well. It's a very good nitrogen source.
So what do you think of blood and bone pellets?
Blood and bone pellets? I'm sure they would work. They would be good. It's just kind of you have to decide, you know, how, where you want to draw your lines and.
Yeah, and decide sort of where they come from.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I put them on the plant the other day, like little bok choy, and I thought, oh, they're on the plant. Does that make the plant safe to eat? So it makes them alive.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to ask about here today.
Right. Yeah, you know, the other thing is, you know, can diseases be transmitted? I've read about there's an antibiotic thing called triclosan, which has been put in a lot of soaps and things like that to make an antibiotic soap. And I was reading not long ago that apparently, you know, when it goes into the sewage system, which is where it's going to go, the treatment plants, all their processes to deal with it don't work on it. So, it, you know, whatever the effluent that comes out in the end that's supposed to be clean still has it in it. And they said that they tested vegetables. I think it was lettuce or carrots that, you know, that was irrigated with this treated waste. And I think it might have even been treated water, you know, so it wasn't sludge or something. It was water that had been treated like that. But they found triclosan in the vegetables. Yeah. Well, I think people have recognized that and they're moving away from it now. Right. So, anyways, plants do uptake things. I've also read about. I think it was lettuce again that took up glyphosate, you know, which is from Roundup, that had been sprayed on a previous crop. It wasn't even sprayed on that crop, but the previous crop had been sprayed, and then they grew lettuce on the field and it took it up. Yeah. Absorbed it, yes. Right.
It was a really high percentage that's been jumped by any from that country. There's a place in California that is okay.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a problem all around the world, what I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah. And there things like that, there also there are places that just have naturally high levels in the soil. And so, but yeah, I heard that story also about the rice. Yeah. We have a product called corn gluten meal that is very nice because it is both a source of nitrogen and it hinders germination. So if you have a bed that you're going to transplant into, you can put your transplants in the bed and then spread corn gluten meal over your bed, and you're providing nitrogen and you're also hindering weeds from germinating in your bed. So corn gluten meal. Yeah. I don't know if that's available here, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is. I think that chances are good you would have that. For phosphorus, we mentioned animal manures tend to be high and tend to have phosphorus in them, so that's one way you can add phosphorus to your soil. But if you need more phosphorus, you can buy rock phosphate that will help. Also, bone meal can be a source of phosphorus. For potassium, I'm not sure what you have available here, but I mentioned green potash here and sulfate of potash. These are both organic sources of potassium. For calcium, you can use lime or gypsum. And then we already mentioned at lunchtime, right before lunch, different sources of micronutrients like kelp meal, seawater, and what was it? Sea Sol is the product that you have here. And diatomaceous earth. Diatomaceous earth is a really...
Should the lot spec on? Because you're not using it for yet.
I'm almost ready to use it, so thanks. Diatomaceous earth is a very interesting product. It's made of fossilized diatoms, which is a very small kind of single cell algae that grows in water, and there are deposits of diatomaceous earth in different places around the world. It's good as a source of silica. It is also good as a pest control. I'll mention it later when we're talking about pests. But it tends to dry out any pest that has an exoskeleton. And people say it's good for deworming. You know, you can, yeah. I mean, people like put it in their feed for their animals, their chickens, and they say it helps to clean them out. People use it themselves. They say it helps to make your hair and your nails stronger, and you know, I don't know. They say it'll also maybe clean you out. So, and they say it has good detoxing properties, but it's if you look at it microscopically, it you know it's got a structure that's like glass shards, and so that's probably one reason it helps to dry out the exoskeleton of things. So people will even in America we can buy it as a you know something to use in your house. It's a white powder that you can just put along like your baseboard and around windows to keep, you know, for cockroaches, ants, and things like that. It's a very safe. You want to look for food grade diatomaceous earth. It's very very safe, but it's very effective on insects that have exoskeletons. Okay, so.
That's the bed preparation. I'm ready to go.
Okay, great.
But if we just go behind it, there's your whole list.
Okay.
That's all that I've got anyway. I don't know whether you've upgraded them, if Paul's upgraded them, but I heard.
Okay. Yeah, I had some. These are his PowerPoints, and I had some actual.
No, those are the movies.
These are the movies. Oh, okay, great.
So I'll go back to QuickTime. You press go.
Okay. Actually, I want to do one on doing a soil test.
Soil census.
Probably the same. Okay. Yeah.
And maximize it.
Yeah. Okay. So. My son has put together an online garden training program, and these are some things from that. It's called Born to Grow.
This is going. I think it was good.
I think it.
It's connected there.
Yeah.
You have, you can easily take a little soil sample from your garden to send in and have tested to find out what kind of nutrients you have in your soil, how you can start amending it and improving it for your garden. And the fact is that the sample that you take and how you take the sample is one of the critical factors for how reliable that soil test is going to turn out and how much you can bank on the results that come back from that soil test and figuring out how you need to start working on amending your garden and building up your soil. And so this is a real key little factor in soil testing is taking the sample. The good news is it's really not that hard. It's very easy to do, and so I'll go ahead and show you how you can do that. All we'll need for taking the soil sample is a good spade, and it's preferable if it has a flat blade. A regular shovel will work as well, but it's preferable with a flat blade. You'll see why in a minute here, and a nice clean bucket for taking your sample in. So what you want to do is take your spade and thrust it down into the ground as deep as you can go, and then pull it back and forth. What we're wanting to do is get what's called a soil profile, a nice profile of the soil all the way down at least 8 to 12 inches or so down into the soil. It could be helpful if your soil is a little moist when you do this. So make a little V that goes down into your soil, and then take your spade and just shave off a little shaving going down your full soil profile all the way down as deep as you can go. Wow, that's beautiful. And that is going to be your soil sample that you can then put in your bucket. Now, to really get reliable results on your soil test, you'll want to get soil samples from all over your garden. You might want to go in like a zigzag pattern over the growing area that you're going to be growing in, and get at least 8 to 10 of these soil profile samples, and that will give you the best. Really, the more you get, the better, and that will give you the best idea. An average over your whole garden area, what kind of nutrients that you have. And the final step here is to make sure that you mix up those soil samples as best as you can. Get them thoroughly mixed up. And then when you get your soil test kit in from whatever company is going to be doing your soil testing, they should send you a little bag or give you instructions for how to send in your soil sample, and you'll use this mixture that you've taken from all these little samples around your garden to send in for the actual soil test.
Okay. So the idea is you take your plot that you're wanting to grow in, and you take random samples. And like you said, the more the better. But, you know, I would say 5 at a minimum, and, you know, 10 would be nice. You take those random samples, mix them up, and then send them in. Now, if you're growing in different places, you'll want to do a separate sample for each place, so that you can, because the soil might be different in that place than where you than the other place. So, any questions on that? I don't see anyone on composting here. Okay, well, maybe we'll do that without this, and then we've got the one on bed making, which is a nice demonstration. So let's turn on the light and the Does anyone know how I can shut this off? Because I want to use the... Pardon? Yeah. No, I don't. I tried doing that. I think the key is over there. Well, okay, there. All right. So, compost. We talked about it before lunch. It's just decomposing organic matter. All right. And what is the benefit of compost? You know, as I said earlier, things break down slowly over time, and so the more you can recognize the material, the less the original material, the less it's decomposed, and so it's going to continue to break down over time, and eventually, it's going to give you a dark brown or black product that you can't tell what it came from. You know, it's broken down so much, and that's the ideal compost. You can. Well, I think I'll start talking about how to do it, and then I'll go here. So the one of the main benefits of compost is this really dark material that we call humus. It's almost a complete breakdown of the organic matter, and then even further breakdown is humates, and an even further product that comes from the breakdown of compost is called fulvic acid. You know, all of these are very rich, not only in nutrients, but they form the, well, like I said before, the food and the housing for your microbes. You know, the more broken down it is, the better for them. It's more readily available for them. So humus has amazing properties. Compost, when you add compost or actually any organic matter to your soil, one thing that it tends to do is buffer your soil. So if you are high in if your pH is high or low, adding organic matter and compost will tend to bring it closer to the center. And also, if you're high or low in certain nutrients, by adding organic matter, you tend to bring it closer to the center. So it has this buffering property that's really helpful. How to make compost? There are two main ingredients two main things we're looking for in compost, and just for simplicity we call them greens and browns. So your greens are fresh items. That's your kitchen scraps. And if you put a dead animal in there, that's going to be a green. But your grass clippings, anything that's fresh is a green. You know, you can put in, you know, sometimes you have crop residues after you've harvested your crop. Those could be greens or browns. It depends what their condition is. But if they're fresh, they're greens. So you have greens, and then you have your browns. The kind of the typical brown, or the ideal brown, is straw. And that hay is a brown, dead leaves are a brown. There are a number of sources of browns. You don't want to usually use something like wood chips as a brown, because, as I mentioned before, they take too long to decompose. If you have access to sawdust or wood chips and, you know, don't mind having it in a heap for a while, I would take it. But it'll probably be 5 years before it's ready for you to actually use it. So, and if it's wood, that's for sawdust. If it's wood chips, it's going to be longer than that. But wood chips are really good as a mulch on the surface. Just don't dig them in. And we like to use wood chips on perennials. You know, for our garden, I'm too worried about digging it in. When I'm harvesting, like if I'm harvesting roots, it's going to make a hole, and wood chips are going to want to fall down in there. You know, if I'm transplanting, I'm digging a hole, and the wood chips are going to want to fall down in there. So I'm worried about using wood chips on my annuals, in the annual production. But they are good on perennials, and they mimic the natural order that perennials grow in. You know, the perennials grow in a woodland where sticks and leaves are falling on them anyway, so that's kind of, that works well. But, so, to make compost, you have greens and browns, and there are two ways you can make compost. You can make a quick pile that you want to, you can make it go, the process go fast, or you can do it slowly. So if you want it to go quickly, it's going to be high management. You know, you've got to watch it closely and turn it regularly. And generally, if you're going to do it quickly, you have to have all the materials for a pile available for you to put in that pile all at once. Now, for us on the farm and for a lot of us at home, that's not really practical. You know, we get the scraps little by little, you know, out of the kitchen. And so in that case, you know, you're making a slow pile. And, you know, a quick pile can be ready to use in, I'd say, 3 months. You know, it depends on how quickly you do it. When I was in college, I actually followed a recipe for 14-day compost. And it wasn't, you know, you could still tell what the parent material was. It wasn't broken down that much. But it was to the point that you could put it on the garden. So you can do it, you know, at that speed. But like I said, you have to have all the material available, and you have to manage it fairly intensively. You have to be watching the temperature and turning it regularly. So the way that we, I'll tell you how to do it, a quick pile. You just, we call it lasagna method of building the pile. So you add your browns, and then you add some green. And generally you're going to want 2 to 4 times as much brown as green. Okay? So you add a thick layer of brown and a thin layer of green on top. And then we'll generally sprinkle some dirt on. Do you know why we would do that? Well, yeah, that's the reason. For building a quick pile, we're not so worried about the flies, but we're inoculating it. Yeah. I wouldn't want to use it in the compost pile. I can tell you a different. It works really well as a mulch, and I can tell you there is something called lasagna bed making using cardboard. That's a different thing. Well, it's a pretty heavy brown, and I said straw is the ideal material for compost.
That's why you don't have access to what would be on
it. Yeah, I would use
cardboard is usually available in many stores. There's a store in
the right.
You can pick it up.
The reason straw is the ideal is that it's a straw. You know, it's a hollow piece of material, and so it allows more circulation of air and water, and then also when you get straw, it's going to be kind of a tangled mess, right? And again, that allows more opening for air and water. The concern about cardboard is that it's flat. And they're going to want to compact flat on top of each other, and that just by them being tight together like that, it's going to hinder the breakdown. It won't break down as quickly.
Regarding chemical composition, cardboard would be adequate.
Yeah, cardboard would be fine if you shredded it. You know, if you could shred it, then that would be great. Right. If you had a chipper shredder or something like that, you know. I think that would, you know, with the paper, one concern would be that it might mat, you know, it's loose, but when it gets wet and gets other things on top of it, so I think I would put a little bit and add some other things on top and then a little more, but yeah. So you just keep building your pile like that. You put a layer of brown, a thick layer of brown, a thinner layer of green, a little dirt, a layer of brown, a layer of green, a little dirt, and you build it up as you know until you've used up your material. You don't usually want to make your pile more than 6 feet diameter, or 6 feet square. Or 6 feet tall, because it does need to breathe. And if it gets bigger than that, it'll tend to compact in the center and it won't decompose as well. And, you know, there are two kinds of decomposition. There's aerobic and anaerobic composition. And they take different kinds of bacteria. Usually, there's nothing wrong with anaerobic bacteria, but for compost you want aerobic bacteria. They'll do a better job. A 6 foot diameter. Usually, if you're inside that, you're not gonna you'll be able to have plenty of air access. If you're concerned about if you are using some fine material and you're concerned about the air and water porosity of your pile, you can take a big bar and punch holes in it or something like that to help. But if you have a lot of material, you know, farmers who are making and people who make compost commercially, they'll do a windrow. So they'll have a row that might be 4 to 6 feet wide, and then they'll just make it long, and it'll be 4 to 6 feet tall, and then they just make it long. So that's the way you do a lot of compost. You don't want it to be, you know, wider than that.
Do you need to cover it up to accelerate the process?
Oh, that's a good point. It is helpful to cover your compost pile for a couple reasons. One is, your compost pile needs moisture. You know, those microbes need moisture in order to live and work. And so they if you are making a pile in a very dry place and with a lot of dry material, you'll usually want to add water to it, you know, sprinkle it, wet it down. And you could do that layer by layer. That would be better than waiting until it's all built and then adding water. So you don't want to overwater because, too much water kind of cools it down and, you know, makes it difficult to work, but a good moisture. So, you know, we like to talk about a moist cake, you know, for the soil or for your compost pile. You know, it needs to be moist, but not so moist that when you squeeze it, water comes out. You know. So, when you if you're in a dry area, covering your pile is very useful because it keeps the moisture in your pile.
Would you cover it totally since we need it to breathe, or just the top, just to shield it maybe from sunlight?
I think you can cover it completely because you're not covering it so tight that you're sealing out any air access. It'll have enough air for that, you know. So, you know, we'll use a tarp, just lay a tarp over it.
You know.
Yeah. They are, but for most home gardeners, the issue is that you've got a lot of greens and not enough browns. And if you have a compost pile that smells, has that ever happened to you? You know, it just starts to stink and attract flies and things like that. Pardon? Cockroaches. Yeah. So if that's happening, most likely the problem is you've got too much green. You need to be adding more browns to your compost pile. That's the most common problem that home gardeners have, is too much green and a stinky pile.
Same home garden situation, you know, once the composting unit was like a little mound.
Okay. Yeah.
You can't get in there to aerate.
Yeah.
Because I think they're designed for the long term
composting. Right.
And then you're mentioning, Cheryl mentioned the tumbling one.
Right. Right.
Those ones are good at that.
They are, but the way, you know, when you're doing a home compost pile, little by little. You know, you're just adding your kitchen scraps every once in a while, you know, probably every day, but it's just little by little. Your pile is going to, you're going to need probably, I mean, the way we tend to do it is that we'll be adding our scraps, both our kitchen scraps and our garden scraps, you know, the residue after harvest, the plant residue.
Carrot tops,
tomato plants, you know, once they're finished and you pull them out, your broccoli plants, or, you know, your cabbage leaves, pardon? Yes, all of that, we put it on the pile. We put it all on the pile. And So we're building it little by little. So what we'll generally do is we'll, over the course of a year, everything goes into that pile, and we're just building the pile. And then we'll start a new pile and let that one sit. And actually we'll try to turn it at least once and let it sit. And after another year, it'll be ready to use. You can, yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Yes. That's a really good point. What we do is we get some hay bales or straw bales and set them next to our compost pile so that we can have a brown to easily add to it, because we've got greens, you know, that are our garden scraps or kitchen scraps, but the browns aren't handy when we want them. So we put the greens on and then we take some brown and put it on top.
Yeah. Did you ever add ash to your compost?
Yes, you can do that.
The meats are empty out those pot bellies, so
yeah.
Like what I do with ash, or if you put something,
right,
you can put it on the compost.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to consistently always put it on, but because it's high in potassium. But you know, if your soil needs potassium, you can just spread it directly on your beds. And you know, so I mean my concern is that if you put it all in the compost pile, it might be too concentrated for it. You know, it depends on how much ash you have.
I was painting and I wasn't the garden. I didn't feel good about throwing that out.
Right.
Should we go back to the compost?
Okay.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.